Rocketing attendances, a record-breaking rising star, and Fred Doane talks tough with some of Britain's biggest racecourses, creating a Betfred blackout. All that and more on this week's edition of The Front Page. Yes, welcome to the first Front Page of 2026. I hope you had a fantastic Christmas and New Year, and I hope the new year brings you much happiness, health and joy, as I do for my two Racing Post colleagues on today's show. Lewis Porteous, hello Lewis.
Hello, great to be here.
And great to see you. And bonjour in Paris to Scott Burton, our France correspondent. Hello Scott.
Hey Lewis, how's it going?
Yeah, it would be wrong to start this week's show without saying that on Friday we lost one of the most senior and respected figures in the training of British horses. Ian Balding, the long-time licence holder at Kingsclere, died last week. And everyone will know that Ian was most closely associated with one of the all-time great racehorses, Mill Reef, but he had a long and stellar training career, former champion trainer, and he had many great horses over the years. And also, of course, he was part of a racing dynasty and the father of one of the sport's current leading trainers, Andrew Balding, and one of our great broadcasters, Claire Balding. Lewis, it was very sad news indeed.
Absolutely, yeah. A real sort of figurehead for the sport. Gave us one of the great horses of the 20th century, Mill Reef, a Derby winner, Eclipse, King George, and an Ark. It sounds like it was a life lived to the max, though. A talented sportsman as well as a talented horseman, it seems. So he'll be sorely missed, but I think arguably his greatest legacy is his family. And as sad as this is, a sad time for the Balding family, but it's great to see that Kingsclere is still flying high, and it must have given him great pleasure to see what Andrew's doing there, and the Balding name lives on.
Yeah, absolutely does. And Scott, you had a personal experience linked to Ian Balding not long after you joined the Racing Post.
It's true, actually. Our colleague Bruff Scott, many years before the Racing Post was founded, was involved in the commissioning and the production of three short feature films, which all released cinematic release, one on Saraiva, one on Nijinsky, and arguably the best of the three of them, Something to Brighten the Morning, which was the story of Mill Reef, and which Albert Finney, an Oscar-winning actor, narrated, ended up being shown in cinemas. It was shown on the BBC at Christmas in 1973 after its cinematic release. And those three films were re-released just at the time I was joining, and I went to speak to Bruff Scott at Epsom to recall the filming of them. And what shone through was just the great training effort that Ian produced in a horse that you should remember. He won the Jim Crack at two. He was winning over six furlongs at two, and yet was running a big race in the Guineas at three, and then as Lewis referenced, vastly a huge impressive winner of the Derby, the Eclipse, King George, and the Ark. And Bruff recalled at the time that they decided in his off season that they would make this film, and the idea was to follow Mill Reef, and so they set off with this huge camera crew to Longchamp for his seasonal comeback at in the Pre-Ganay, and they had about 10 different cameras, and the sequence in the film is very much of its time. It's almost psychedelic the way they cut between all the different the different angles, and then following that, Mill Reef then sustained a career-ending injury on the gallop, and it's very moving, the care that's given to him by the whole team at Kingsclere. Ian obviously is a key part of that. There's other bits of the film which are filmed at his owner, breeder, Paul Mellon's estate in the United States, Rokeby. It's a really, really, it's very of its time, but it's a really moving film, and I urge anybody who wants to find out more about Mill Reef to seek it out. It's on YouTube. Again, when I was first getting into racing, some of his horses, Glint of Gold, was another Mellon horse who I'm sure Lee you remember as well, as we're both very, very fond of Shergar, and he chased Shergar home in the Derby, but went on to win win big races at home and abroad. When you walk through the betting hall at Saint-Cloud Racecourse now, there are the colours up of all the past winners of the Grand Prix of Saint-Cloud, and Glint of Gold won that race, Diamond Shoal also for Mellon and Balding the following year as well. He obviously trained greats great sprinters like Loxong for Mr. Smith. Just a litany of excellence. I think everybody who has anything to do with Kingsclear now would say that that's continued. It's just a proper finishing school where a good horse was always given the chance to thrive. And as Lewis says, he's through Andrew and Claire, obviously the name lives on, but just a huge part of the racing landscape for half a century.
Yeah, absolutely right. And we send our sincere condolences to all the Balding family and to Ian Balding's loved ones and friends. It was a great week for Cheltenham last week. The first meeting of the new year at the racecourse. In fact, the first meeting, first big meeting of the new year anywhere took place at Cheltenham on New Year's Day, as is traditionally the case. And there was a segue between the Christmas period and New Year in terms of strong attendances across major meetings and smaller meetings in Britain and Ireland. We've seen a record crowd already for Long Walk Hurdle Day. Ascot, Kempton's Christmas Festival, had bumper attendances with a 23% year-on-year rise for the Boxing Day and December 27th meeting there. Some smaller tracks had great numbers, including Warwick, which was sold out on New Year's Eve. Leopardstown's figures for their Christmas Festival were well up again on last year. But perhaps the most striking of all came at Cheltenham on January the 1st. Now, historically, this was a two-day meeting that went across New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. Around 20 years ago, it went to a single fixture on January the 1st. When that first happened, they were getting around 18, 19, 20,000 people for that day. Over the years, that number has risen significantly, and it surged this year with over 44,000 people attending the meeting, and it became a sellout as well, with all tickets sold for the day. Now, that was represented a massive increase, around 6,000 people on the previous best for that meeting. It also meant that in the main public enclosures, Cheltenham was as busy as it would be on Cheltenham Gold Cup Day, because for the festival, there are many more temporary facilities used across the site. It was extremely encouraging for a racecourse that will be in the spotlight again when we get to March, not just for the racing at the festival, but for how many people go along to Cheltenham, where we know that across the last 3 years there's been a massive drop-off in festival attendances. I asked the new chief executive there, Guy Lavender, what this meant for the festival and whether sales are going well, and he spoke in very positive terms about how things are looking for March and said that he has confidence in where they are now, and with another big sales window coming up, he was really upbeat in terms of what we can expect in March, when we know that for the Jockey Club, for Cheltenham being its most commercially profitable racecourse, it really needs a strong festival, and it needs to correct and reverse the attendance falls of recent years. So, Lewis, I know you were watching on TV, and you were saying off air that you'd noted yourself looking at the pictures how busy Cheltenham was.
Yeah, it's a great picture from the bottom of the betting ring, just looking up, absolutely jam-packed. Great way to start the new year, a real boost for the sport. I just felt over Christmas and New Year it was a big win for racing in general. We had the King George result that took the sport from the back pages to the front pages, and then there was more good news with crowds, like you said there, across keenly attended across from the bottom to the top, not just the big events, the smaller tracks were getting the great crowds as well. So it bodes really well going into a new year, especially when, you know, halfway through 2025, we were really worried about attendances after the festival and things like that. So it's a positive footing to start on, and now it's about consolidating and capitalising on these people that seem to have an appetite to get back out to these live sporting events. And I think when you look at somewhere like Newbury, which was a success story of 2025, like Sean Hines has gone in there, and as corny as it might sound, he has made customer king again. He's setting up the facilities to cater for these crowds. He's giving value for money, and if you put on a great sporting event with the facilities that can cope and you make the customer feel welcome, they will come back, and that's what British Racing has to do at this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And Scott, it's pretty rare to be able to give such a positive story such prominence, but the numbers were fantastic across so many meetings. Lewis references Newbury. I think just about every fixture bar one maybe in 2025 had a big attendance increase on 2024. Cheltenham's story hadn't been so positive, so the New Year's Day figure really hopefully does bode well for the future.
I think so much of these things go on kind of word of mouth, really. If you get groups of family or friends who go and have a positive experience, and they will say, yes, there was enough people on to take my bets, there were enough people on to serve me if I wanted a drink, I could carry my drink everywhere I wanted to go. There was a really good feel about the place, a buzz about the place. Positive experience means you're much, much more likely to come back. And I think part of the issue with the Cheltenham Festival for the last couple of years was there was a huge pent-up appetite to go back the first full year after COVID in 2022, and to not be overcritical, they got a few things wrong on the staffing front, on the kind of the attitude of some of the stewards and all the rest of it, and it felt overcrowded, and a lot of people felt that they wouldn't go back for that. Now, we know there's lots and lots of other issues that are specific to the Cheltenham Festival because it's over a number of days and accommodation is so expensive in and around Cheltenham. But that experience thing, people going back and saying, well, I'm not really sure I want to do that again, that spreads across around families and especially through friend groups, people who are on WhatsApp groups and all the rest of it. And so I think if that's true, then the reverse of that is true. And I think if 44,000 people have gone and had a really good day on New Year's Day, that's a day that's been building for a number of years now. It's a big family day. They do lots and lots and lots for young children and all the rest of it. But the kinds of people they need to be rebooking for March, the people who are going to come close to selling out Champion Hurdle Day and Gold Cup Day, are not necessarily all families. You're looking at more adult and adult groups of people going, families and groups of friends. And if those WhatsApp groups start humming and saying, look, brilliant time, we've definitely got to book, you know, we were going to go for one day in March, but we've got to go and book for three now or whatever, I think that's where the growth will come.
And Lewis, one other significant thing about that New Year's Day was how young it was. You know, there was a real strong cohort of young race goers. I think the figure was something like over 6,000 people there under 18, which is not something that has been unique recently. You know, we've seen a lot of fixtures with a noticeable large number of young race goers. You get that a lot of the big international meetings, but it's something that's vital over here as well.
I thought it's hugely positive. I mean, rewind, 2 years ago, we were worrying where the next generation of racegoers was coming from. It was an ageing clientele, and there just didn't seem to be an appetite among the youngsters. Like, what exactly has happened to break through? It's hard to put your finger on, but 6,000 was a huge bonus. And throughout the Christmas period, there just seemed to be a lot of young, new race goers on course. And they're vital for our future. Like, we've got to keep our core customers happy. Of course we have, but we've got to sing out to these the new generation too. And hopefully racing's grasping that now. And a lot of those people that were there on New Year's Day, hopefully they had a great experience and they'll be back come March.
Actually, on that one, we've got not long off now, we're coming up the first Invades Friday Night Live meeting at Wolverhampton. Interesting to see how that goes well, because again, that is a massive attempt to get young people engaged in racing.
Yeah. I tip my hat to Invades, to be honest, because you've got to give them some credit for these youngsters coming through the gates. It's something different. It won't suit everyone, but We can cater for different people. We shouldn't be scared of saying that. We're not just don't have to be one size fits all. We can reach out to different groups, and there's no reason why they can't be on the race course in harmony together and enjoy this action.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the action, Scott, it maybe wasn't the greatest quality Cheltenham fixture ever staged, but it did produce one headline-making performance from Cabral Dumatin, who was very impressive in the Relkill hurdle. Harry Skelton, his jockey, immediately said that he wasn't convinced by any means the horse was a three-miler, which put doubts about the horse's participation in the stayers hurdle, for which he was then around a 6 or 7 to 1 shot. And subsequently, Dan Skelton has said that while he'll have an entry in the stayers, more likely this season is a national spirit hurdle at Fontwell and then entry hurdle route at the Grand National Festival. Right call or wrong call?
I completely understand where they're coming from on an age point of view more than anything else. He's just turned 5, hasn't he? He obviously had a slight pull at the weights for that. He was very, very impressive. And the obvious temptation is to say, well, we're going to have a go at Cheltenham because we know he acts on the track. He's run so well around there. That's a big tick in the box before you get to whether he'll stay the distance. But I think they're playing the long game here. They're saying, you know, with a bit of luck, we've got 3 or 4 more seasons to enjoy this guy. He's clearly very, very talented. And they hope that maybe with racing, he'll learn to settle a bit better. He didn't pull like a train the other day at Cheltenham, but he was just obviously always taking Harry to his hurdles. He kind of couldn't wait to get between the hurdles and onto the next thing. And for a stayers hurdle, understandably, that maybe they're a little bit worried that he might just do too much too early. But he's just a serious talent, isn't he? I mean, you know, the one thing Dan Skelton said he wouldn't do is drop him back in trip. But hopefully he's one we can look forward to for a long time down the road. I think it's more his age than anything to do with his style of racing. But he's clearly very, very talented.
Yeah, definitely is. As is Billy Loughnan, the once rising, now risen star of the flat weighing room. Still an extremely young jockey, but an extremely prolific jockey, and last week he broke or set a new record, 21st century record for calendar wins in a British year, with 222 winners on the board, surpassing the previous best set by Kieran Fallon. Lewis, he's a remarkable young man, Billy Loughnan. Whenever you hear him talk, he seems like a very good communicator. He's a superb jockey. And that level, although it's only a 21st century record, and you can say, well, Kieran Fallon did it off fewer rides than Billy Loughnan, it's still a huge achievement.
It's a phenomenal. It's been a phenomenal story from the start, though, hasn't it? He didn't start riding until 2022. His yearly tallies since then have been 6, 130, 162, and now 222. It's absolutely phenomenal. And I think the most amazing thing to me is that you see so many careers drop off a cliff when jockeys lose the claim, whereas there's just been no lull or no blip with this kid. He's just phenomenally driven, a natural talent, and to get to 222, and you know, it's more than your Murphys, your Buicks, your Fallons have ever achieved. I think it's astounding, quite frankly. I mean, key has been the relationship with George Bowie. What you've got is the perfect sum of these two young, ambitious guys working together. There's a real sort of rapport between the two. You can see that on course. They look like they're enjoying every moment of the journey. And it's also, it was quite striking to watch last year how Charlie Appleby started to bring Loughnane more and more into the Godolphin fold. I just found it quite interesting that he's gone out to Dubai now for a little stint, and what that means for the future, we'll see. But I think Appleby will probably be keen to use him more and more going forward. Buick's still in his prime. I'm not talking about anything like that. But what I guess what it bodes well for Billy is that these relationships will probably start only get stronger and stronger, and inevitably that should launch him into maybe a title challenge this season.
Yeah, well, on that one, Scott, Oisin Murphy retained his crown in 2025 and by clear daylight as well. Is Billy Lochnan now the heir apparent for the champion jockey title?
I'm sure he'll be the guy chasing Oisin the hardest. I suspect whether Murphy wants to challenge for the title will have a big bearing on this. Obviously, nobody's champion jockey unless they really try very hard for it. I think if he wants it again, and he's made reference in each of the last couple of years that maybe he'll take a different approach the following season, and then he has ended up racking up big numbers. If he wants it again, I think he'll still be very, very hard to beat. The thing that's going to be interesting to me with Lochnane is that he's going to now, obviously, he's ridden 222 in an era when you can only ride at one meeting a day. You've got to bear in mind that although Fallon had a lot fewer rides in his 2-2-1 season in 2003, he could ride in the afternoon at Newmarket, he'd go to Windsor in the evening. You can't do that anymore. I think the more Billy is in demand for the bigger stables, the more he's going to have to be at wherever the biggest meeting is in the day. And so Thursday, Friday, Saturday in a week, or more than that in a festival, he's going to be riding in the most competitive races. Not only going to be riding against the best jockeys, but he's going to be riding in the Class 2 handicaps, the listed races, the group races, where it's harder to get winners. He's going to be riding a lot fewer cheap Class 6s and Class 5s. And so I think his numbers, I think it's not necessarily realistic to think he's going to carry on riding 200-plus winners every year. But he's going to be riding in better races, and he's going to be winning bigger races as well. And I think that will obviously be very important to him. Ironically, Oisin obviously still has a close tie with Andrew Balding, and his retainers, such as they are with owners that don't have a vast number of horses in training. So he's obviously still number one for Qatar Racing. They've had fewer horses in training recently. He's also now got a link up with the owners of that previously used Holly Doyle as well, Imad Al-Sagar. Again, they don't have a vast number of horses in training. So ironically, Oisin's probably got a bit more flexibility to go to whichever meeting his agent says you might ride four winners at. And Billy might have a little bit less flexibility between George Bowie and Charlie Appleby. That said, you know, his agent knows exactly what he's doing. He clearly was prepared to go everywhere and anywhere to ride last year. 1,300 odd rides is a phenomenal number, especially, as I say, in an era when you can only ride at one meeting in a year. So he's got the hunger. He doesn't like doing anything else other than riding horses. So why not?
Yeah, and Scott references his agent. Well, Tony Hind, Billy's agent, is the man who makes champion jockeys. So I would be amazed if he hasn't got a very healthy appetite to make Billy the champion in 2026. Lewis, just occurs with one person I wanted to reference as well on the jockey front is Ben Bromley, conditional jockey, who announced last week that he had retired from the saddle, basically because he wasn't enjoying it anymore. He's 23 years old. He sees an opportunity to take his life in a completely different direction, will now train to be a ski instructor. And I just thought it was so impressive and commendable from someone like that, who is born and bred horse racing but wasn't getting the satisfaction and pleasure from it that he hoped he would get, to be brave enough to take a different life path. And I thought that was extremely impressive, and sort of send good wishes to him.
Absolutely, yeah, wish him all the best. I think bravery is a key word there. Just one, to make the decision, and two, to speak so openly about it.
Yeah.
And it gives other people who might be struggling or might not be enjoying it, it makes it okay, doesn't it? And yeah, he spoke fantastically when he spoke to Maddie Playle, and it reminded me a little bit of the Harry Derham situation, where these people are so entrenched in racing, yeah, it doesn't always turn, life doesn't always turn out like we expect, and he wasn't enjoying his race riding, and he's going to look for another avenue, and good luck to him. And Harry did the same, and Harry's a phenomenal trainer now in his own right. So it's not for everyone, but he gave it a go. He had success, and I'm sure he'll be successful in his next career.
Yeah, absolutely. Lewis references Maddie's piece with Bren Bromley. You'll easily be able to find that on our digital platforms. Another plug now, all week long, we've got a big series of pieces under the name Masters of Betting. Five features across Racing Post platforms this week that look at some of the very biggest and most successful punters of the present day and in the past. In today's Racing Post newspaper and across, say, the digital platforms, I've done an interview with Don Johnson, an American who won $15 million from Atlantic City across a 5-month period and is now one of the world's very biggest racing punters, specialising in computer-assisted wagering. On Tuesday, we've got an interview with a 40-year-long pro punter, Steve Lewis Hamilton. We've got an interview with Alan Potts, who in the 90s dominated the betting ring. And we've got profiles of the legendary figure Phil Bull and Tony Bloom, who, as well as being a huge racehorse owner now and a football figure, is also and historically has been one of the very biggest punters in the game. So Masters of Betting series all week long in the Racing Post. And with betting in mind, there was a big betting story. Came out actually on New Year's Day when it emerged that Betfred would not be showing racing from tracks linked to the Arena Racing Company venture, the Racing Partnership, due to a failure to agree a new media rights deal with the Racing Partnership. So Betfred, it's impacted them, and also it's impacted some independent firms. And Scott, you're right across this story.
I've been digging away for several days trying to get to the bottom of whether this is, as one person put it to me, just a kind of a seasonal glitch, a deal that didn't quite get over the line before Christmas and nobody's been at their desk for 2 weeks. That's the way one person put it to me. On the other side, it would appear that Arena and the Racing Partnership have asked for a substantial increase in the fees paid by both Betfred and these independent bookmakers for the data and for the picture rights as well. In the Betfred shops, that has meant that what racing has gone ahead that has been either from an Arena track or one of the associated independent tracks. There's been no pictures and they have, as far as we can determine, been instructed not to take bets after the official off time, even if a race is late off, to actually close their books on races that they can't show the pictures of at the official off time. It's obviously that's a blow to customers in the shops, and people will vote with their feet, you imagine, and go down the road to another bookmakers that is showing those races. In terms of the independents, the pictures are still being shown, I think, more just through the logistics of it than anything else. But some of the figures that are being talked about are, on the face of it, quite surprising, really, in a climate where the betting industry has suffered a number of tax rises. Obviously, land-based bookmakers were, racing was exempt from a rise in tax in the budget, and also there was no rise in machine gaming tax, which is the betting terminals in betting shops. But figures around the 30% mark have been mentioned to me in terms of a rise in the fee per shop for the independents. Clearly, there is more to this than just the timing of Christmas. Clearly, the Racing Partnership, Arena principally, have asked for a substantial increase. Martin Cruddas, the chief executive of Arena, a couple of years ago, I think it was January 2024, in an interview with our industry editor, Bill Barber, pointed out that, if you go back to the conversation we were having about Cheltenham, that most of the tracks in their group do not have the luxury of 4 or 5 day festivals with 60, 70, 80,000 people through the gates, all spending money on hospitality and concessions. And that, he said at the time, of their 580-odd race meetings in a year, all but about 100 of them would make a loss without media rights. So this is clearly a very, very important part of their business model. They have a different business model to, I don't know, a Cheltenham or an Ascot, which is actually part of the racing partnership, where actually what happens on the premises is a very large part of their turnover. There's clearly a gap between how Arena value those media rights and how the bookmakers involved, so that's Betfred and the Independents, value them to them. We obviously have to hope that there will be some kind of meeting of minds at some stage this week, and this can be resolved very, very quickly, because this is not, it happens to be Betfred now, but there will be a number of these deals which are due for renegotiation within the next year or 18 months. And in an era when we're all being urged for racing and betting to work more closely together, for racing to work more closely across its own constituent parts, then if there's this much of a mismatch between what one side of the industry values the picture rights at and the media rights and the other, then that doesn't bode terribly well for any other kinds of forms of cooperation.
No. And Lewis, I think when we had that situation last year with the tax rises for bookmakers, and we know that bookmakers were aggrieved by what they perceived to be racing ploughing its own furrow and to an extent aligning with anti-gambling campaigners, that there was always the likelihood that when media rights deals had to be done, that the negotiations would be difficult and not necessarily that harmonious. That appears to be playing out, although as Scott implies, that the rises that are being asked of bookmakers are extremely significant.
Yeah, bookmakers warned that there'd be tightening of purse strings. I mean, racing got a carve out from the tax, but bookmakers got hit hard. So on one hand, it's not surprising, and we have been here before and we'll be here again, but ultimately the wider sport suffers. The main source of funding for the sport is the levy, which is bets placed, and the other people that miss out are the punters, the people going into shops, and they can't watch a race. It's hard to get your head around, really. It does feel like we were talking about all those positive stories at the start of the show. That's one step forward. When you read stuff like this, it's a step back. It's amazing it's got to this situation, and sort of a 30% hike and things like that. They've got to be a little bit careful, the racing partnership, because especially with a firm like Betfred, it's incredibly important to racing. They sponsor the 5 British classics,
including one at the Narc track,
including the St Leger at Doncaster. It seems a little bit of a risky game to play in my eyes. I understand it's a commercialism, and they're both commercial organisations, and this might be what goes on behind the scenes on a regular basis, but that relationship between tracks, the wider British racing and bookmakers has got to be strong, because our model, as well as a levy, it relies on heavy bookmaker sponsorship and support from bookmakers.
That being the case, that sort of links just to a little plug for the piece I wrote in the column today. Lewis talks about sponsorship there and how much of it comes from bookmakers. Bookmakers also do an awful lot of advertising within the racing sector, including primarily on ITV through the mainstream television coverage of the sport there. I referenced in the column today that there was emerged over the weekend that there's been a new survey in relation to gambling advertising in Britain. The survey was commissioned by a campaign group, the Coalition to End Gambling Ads. Its objective is clearly what it says on the tin there. They've used the survey results, which apparently suggests that there is a support within those polled for heavier restrictions on gambling advertising, that they are calling on the government to take a more restrictive view of gambling advertising in Britain, and I referenced in the column that that brings great dangers for British horse racing, not just because of the amount that bookmakers sponsor in British horse racing, but because if you look at the ITV racing situation, that is sponsored by Paddy Power. Bookmaker advertising is a big part of funding for the programme. ITV makes money out of its horse racing coverage, which is good for ITV and it's good for British horse racing too. And the reality is that if we ever had a situation where gambling advertising was banned in Britain in the same way that it's set to be banned in Ireland following the passing of legislation there, it would have huge consequences for the sport. Scott, it's at the minute it's just a campaign group calling for something, and the government saying that they haven't got anything immediately on their agenda. But we've seen the situation in Ireland where you have a government there that is historically has always been more closely aligned with horse racing than any UK government has been, and yet similar legislation was passed in Ireland. So it's a warning there, and it's also a reminder that those who have been campaigning against gambling and against gambling harm, that they were never going to go away just because they had one big success on the tax front.
No, absolutely. I think it's clearly governments watch in any given area of public life what's going on in neighbouring countries. So I'm sure that the UK government will be very, very well aware of what the Irish government has done. I suppose the one crumb of comfort you can take from the campaign to axe the racing tax last year is that UK Racing PLC, if you like, managed to convince a government which, by probably historical connection, wouldn't necessarily say that Labour governments are the natural constituency of many people in horse racing. I'm sure I'm not talking about individuals at a lower level, but probably most of the trainers and most of the administrators who were lobbying the government would have at least as many connections with the other side of the aisle, should we say, in terms of people that they could ring up and talk through the problem. The fact that racing managed to successfully carry its message to some extent with a Labour government means that some of the groundwork which would need to be done in terms of persuading them that a gambling ban would be catastrophically harmful has already been done. The government already understands the nature of employment, rural employment, the nature of the amount of money that it generates in terms of tax revenue for the Exchequer. So those arguments have already been made, and the people in post in the Treasury and in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport have already got their heads around that kind of thing. Now, the number of times you can go to the well and say, we asked you not to do this, but we're now asking you not to do this as well because of all those reasons, that then becomes another issue. But I think it's a positive thing that racing seems to have won itself a few friends in government and also amongst Labour backbenchers as well. So you have to hope that they're saying that it's the government's saying it's not a priority at the moment, and that will remain the case as well. Because as you say, the notion of more than 100 days of free-to-air racing on ITV and more than 70 days of that on ITV1, that would come under very, very serious threat if bookmaker advertising was banned.
It would, but I completely agree with the point Scott makes there about the fact that racing did win a lot of friends with government last year. And return to the top story from today's show, a government that sees how many more people have been going to racing and to big fixtures in recent times. That can only be positive for how the sport is viewed in Westminster and Whitehall. That then, I think, covers all bases for us in this first show of 2026. Lewis, hope you're set for a good week.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. I've got a trip to Nick Schofield's yard in Lambourne lined up. A guy who Was one of the winners over the Christmas period with his first listed success and making a good fist of training, having been a successful rider. So I'm looking forward to that, Lee.
Yes, that's to come on Racing Post platforms. And Scott, you say you'll be keeping us abreast of the situation re the Betfred and Indy bookmakers blackout.
Yeah, that's absolutely first order of business. I will be getting out and about at the end of next week. I'm going off to go and see what all the fuss is about with trotting racing, which is obviously huge in France, and it's not something I've ever covered to any great extent in the past, but I'm going to go and do some reporting around the build-up to the Prix de Mairie, which is kind of like the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, but for harness racing, for trotting. So hopefully there'll be some thrills and spills to report from that as well.
Well, all that is to come then. Scott, wrap up warm when you're doing that. Wrap up warm wherever you are. I hope your boilers stay functioning and that you manage to get out and hopefully enjoy a bit of racing as the week goes on. We will be back next week. Until then, thanks for watching and bye-bye.